Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Dan Polson. I'm the assistant federal defender representing the appellant Sean Wright. This is a habeas case, and the question is whether or not Mr. Wright can establish that he is in custody pursuant to the judgment of the state of Alaska, which he seeks to collaterally attack. Mr. Wright was prosecuted and convicted in the state of Alaska for a sex offense. And as a result of that conviction, he is now classified as a sex offender. The judgment that he received explained that he had to register as a sex offender for life, and that notice was signed by the judge. Pursuant to that judgment, Mr. Wright was branded a sex offender, and he was subsequently prosecuted in Tennessee, in federal court in Tennessee, for failing to register as a sex offender. There's no question that because Mr. Wright is presently on supervised release, that he is subject to restraints on his freedom and liberty that are not shared by the public generally. He qualifies as in custody. The remaining question is whether or not Mr. Wright can show that his custodial status is attributed to the judgment of the state of Alaska.
Can I ask even a more threshold question, and maybe it's rolled up into the question you're about to answer. But the most analogous case, perhaps, from our court is Zikro versus Idaho. It's interesting because the underlying conviction was in Idaho, and then he was incarcerated for violating the registration requirement in Idaho. Here you have a case where he's left Alaska, and your argument is that because he's on supervised release, that's equivalent to incarceration, but that's in Tennessee. So why wouldn't the habeas case that he has be properly brought in Tennessee and not in Alaska?
And Zichko is, I think, the governing case. And I don't think that the circumstances of Zichko are as distinguishable as the respondent makes it seem. Zichko did not dwell on the fact that the petitioner in that case happened to have been prosecuted for failing to register as a sex offender in the same state where the underlying predicate rape conviction was imposed. What this court held was, and I'm quoting from Zichko 247 F3rd at 1019, we now hold that a habeas petitioner is, quote, in custody for the purposes of challenging an earlier expired rape conviction when he is incarcerated for failing to comply with the state sex offender registration law because the earlier rape conviction is a, quote, necessary predicate to the failure to register charge. The court didn't
draw... Counsel, that's true. That's true. But the general habeas statute says that the case must be brought in the jurisdiction where the petitioner is confined.
Well, actually, I don't think it spells that out. I think it just provides that the petitioner must be in custody pursuant to the judgment of a state court. And
I thought we had cases that said that it has to be brought in the jurisdiction where he is in custody.
And our position is that the custodial effects that Mr. Wright is experiencing in Tennessee are pursuant to the judgment of the state of Alaska. His status as a sex offender
The question is whether that's enough. I understand the argument, but I am concerned about our case law that says you have to bring it. We do this all the time. We transfer habeas cases all the time to jurisdictions around the country because the general principle, and I'm not aware of exceptions. Now, maybe this is some sort of weird exception. But the court that has jurisdiction over the habeas petition is where he's in custody. And so the question is he in custody in Tennessee? The answer seems to be yes. You're trying to say, or potentially yes, you're trying to say, yeah, he's in custody in Tennessee, but it's pursuant to an underlying Alaska requirement.
I think the respondent argued in their brief that this is about a status offense. That's what failure to register as a sex offender is. And what I think is important here and what maybe the Third Circuit's decision in Piasecki highlights is that we have replaced this patchwork quilt of registration requirements. SORNA has the effect of making sure that every person who is a sex offender, who is branded as a sex offender, whether it's in Alaska, Missouri, Washington, wherever, that they are subject to the same reporting requirements.
Well, I thought they weren't subject to the same reporting requirements, and that's part of the issue here. Because in some of the other cases,
that were under SORNA, there wasn't some of the requirements here that are, in my view, somewhat egregious and might support your position are that he can't buy a home within 1,000 feet of a school. Now, my understanding is this, and maybe correct me if I've got this wrong, but that not every state has adopted that same requirement, but Tennessee has.
Well, there are criminal penalties that are attached, but for example, you can't go into a public library if you're a sex offender in Tennessee.
Right. That's another one in Tennessee.
But I
is
think
that true in every other state?
Well, what we're talking about, and I think what the court should be focusing on, is the registration requirements themselves, because it requires him to appear in person at particular times. And that will, and
I got to be honest, I didn't find that particularly compelling. And, well, and I would, think we've got other courts that have rejected that argument.
I would call the court's attention to what this, to Dow. And I think Barry is the other case. And those are cases where this court found habeas jurisdiction to apply for things like having to appear at alcohol education classes, right? Being required to be someplace at a certain time was sufficient.
But hold on, back up. The alcohol education class was like a 14-hour class. He had to be there. I mean, I don't think that the state imposes a whole bunch of requirements. You go in and get your driver's license. You got to go in and register. So I don't think the in-person registration, at least in my view, that wasn't compelling. To me, the compelling part was you can't go into a public library. I mean, true restriction on freedom. You can't go into a public library. You can't live within 1,000 feet of a house of a school. So my question is, and I think you've answered it, those two requirements in and of themselves are specific to Tennessee. They may be in other states as well, but Tennessee wasn't required to adopt those pursuant to the federal law.
And I would say that I think what you've described is not consistent with the way that custody has been defined historically, that custody is simply a restriction on your freedom of movement. It's whether or not you can come and go as you please. Bear in mind that, and I realize this is sort of an eye of the beholder kind of a situation, but if you were subject to some of these restrictions, I think you would find it unduly burdensome to have to show up in person, check in with the registration office.
I hate it. And whenever I move, I got to go in and register
exactly.
My car, and I've got to, but I mean, how can we say that that's unduly burdensome? I mean, that's just a requirement that happens. There's a litany of things you have to do when you
correct. And the penalties for failing to comply with those restrictions is that you face criminal prosecution.
Okay,
so
that's fine.
Mr. Paul, let me ask a question. I mean, when you were talking about the SORNA and the registration requirements, but there appears to be circuit split on that issue, and I guess you're pointing us toward the Third Circuit, but why the Third Circuit over the Fourth, Sixth, and Tenth Circuits that have called these requirements collateral? I know you were discussing that right now with Judge Nelson, but why are they sufficiently significant? I mean, if I could just put it in this kind of posture between the two circuits, why go with the Third Circuit instead of the others?
Right, and we talk about this in the opening brief, but it's, I think, instructive that the Third Circuit drew from this circuit's precedent, in particular Dow, I think it was Dow and Barry, to find that the registration requirements imposed under SORNA were custodial. So I think the Third Circuit was building on a foundation of this circuit's precedent. And really, it's one of the first decisions to really analyze the post-SORNA regime. All those prior cases that you're referencing, or at least this court's prior precedents, involved the Megan's Law, the pre-SORNA registration requirements.
And you're talking about Williams and Henry and McGrath. Uh-huh. And so let me understand your argument. So you say that these conditions are more custodial, are more reminiscent of supervised release or probation conditions than not. That's what your argument is, right?
Yes.
All right. And so they're more custodial nature as opposed to collateral consequences to his conviction. But I want to understand your argument. So are you making two arguments here? regarding Zinko.
Zichko, yes.
I'm sorry, Zichko and the predicate offense.
Yes.
You know, and then in the alternative, sorta.
Yes.
Is that, so can you just relay that out?
Yeah, I'll make it. So this court does not need to. I think that Zichko controls the outcome of this case. I think that we're on all fours. I don't think this court needs to necessarily engage with whether or not post-SORNA registration requirements are custodial. But certainly if the court is not persuaded by the Zichko analysis, certainly I think the Third Circuit's analysis in Piasecki and just the reality of what SORNA means, its burdens, I think compel the conclusion that it is custodial. And with that, I think I've gone over. So
your time, but we will give you a minute for rebuttal. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll hear from the government. Mr. Terrell?
Yes. Can you hear me, Your Honor?
We can hear you. Can't see you.
Okay, I'm trying to, there we go, join.
There you go.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. I'm Tim Terrell. I'm here on behalf of the state of Alaska. Mr. Wright claims that he's in custody because of his federal supervised release status with his Tennessee U.S. District Court conviction and because of the consequences of the federal sex offender registry and in Tennessee as well. But in the state's view, Judge Singleton correctly distinguished Zichko in that sense because all of those things are consequences that arise from the actions of a separate sovereign than the state of Alaska. And as I pointed out in my brief, there's three cases from this circuit, the Contreras versus Schiltgen, Allen versus Oregon, and Resendez versus Kavinsky, where this court has recognized the separate sovereign's rationale. And
Mr. Terrell, if I can, I read Contreras and Al, I've read it and I reviewed them, and it seems to me that those cases may be distinguishable because there we avoided this necessary predicate question by construing the petitioner's 2254 petitions as a 2241 petition and deciding them on the merits. In fact, Contreras explicitly left open the possibility that the petitioner in that case was in custody on a subsequent deportation charge for purposes of 2254. So I'm not, why doesn't that render Contreras in a posit?
Going back, I'm not sure, but I think Allen most clearly, Contreras and Resendez are both deportation INS type cases, but I think Allen is, you know, clearly most analogous to this situation, and again, recognize the separate sovereign's exception. And also, I would point out the two circuits outside this circuit, the Diaz case from the 11th Circuit and the Brown versus Warden case from the 10th Circuit have also endorsed the separate sovereign's rationale. And so I really think that rationale is just enough to distinguish Zichko, but
you spent a lot of your time in your brief arguing that we should overrule Zichko. I think you call it an outlier in its holding and that its reasoning is erroneous. But you only cite to an unpublished decision by the Third Circuit that was later overruled by a published opinion and a couple of out of circuit district court decisions, all of which are not controlling. So I'm not finding that persuasive, but I wanted to give you an opportunity here to address that.
Well, I'm not sure if the Third Circuit decision, the unpublished decision, was overruled for its distinguishment of Zichko, but in any event, Zichko contains several errors. Zichko said that with respect to when it was describing the United States Supreme Court decision in Lackawanna versus Koss, it was talking about sequential convictions, and it said that Lackawanna had held that the person was in custody with respect to the first conviction, when in fact Lackawanna said that the person was in custody with respect to the second conviction as enhanced by the first conviction. And Lackawanna also made clear that the habeas case couldn't be used as a vehicle to attack the first conviction. And in two cases from this court subsequent to Zichko, and the Dubrin versus California case that I cite, and also another case, Nunes versus Palmer, this court is both sub salientio twice undercut sort of both aspects that Zichko relies on. And so I'm really asking this court just to go all the way and stop the sub salientio distinguishment of Zichko and just recognize that Zichko was incorrect and needs to be.
Well, but you realize we can't do that as a three judge panel. So, I mean, I think your better argument, and this is what I'm interested in, and maybe your state sovereign's point exception is the same thing I was getting at, is why, if he's in custody, and there does seem to be, whether you look at Zichko or some of our other precedent, there does seem to be some suggestion that he's in custody with these supervised release requirements. But to me, that is in Tennessee. And so why would we jump into the fray there? And I mean, is that a viable distinguishing factor from Zichko?
Well, yes. I mean, that's the heart, in essence, of the separate sovereign's rationale. But as far as pointing out that you can, as a panel, undercut or distinguish and overrule Zichko, I mean, normally, I cited case law in my brief. Normally, it's the case that one panel cannot override another panel decision. But there is case law from this court that says that certainly it can do that when the rationale of the underlying panel's decision has been fatally undercut by Supreme Court precedent. And I think Lackawanna.
What's that Supreme Court precedent?
It's intervening Supreme Court precedent.
Yes, and I think the U.S. Supreme Court's subsequent decision in, if I may find it here, Johnson versus United States in 125 Supreme Court 1571 clearly explained and endorsed the rationale of the Lackawanna and Koss decisions. And I think.
What year was that?
Did you cite that case in your brief?
I did not.
What year was it decided?
2005.
Lackawanna? Is that what you're talking about?
No, I'm talking about
Johnson.
Johnson versus United States. It's 125 Supreme Court 1571. But I think both, again, this circuit's Dubrin versus Palmer, or Dubrin versus California, and the Nunes versus Palmer case, both are cases that where this court has, in essence, rejected both.
Are those published decisions?
Yes, they are. Nunes versus Palmer is in 485 F3rd. I'm sorry, I don't have the pinpoint site, but it's in volume 485 of the F3rds.
And what was the other one?
Dubrin versus California, and I cite that in my brief. It's
let me give you a chance to argue before your time is up. Why this case? These conditions here are different from probation or supervised release. Because let's say Zinko, you say it doesn't control. Let's assume that it doesn't. Then why aren't these conditions like the alcohol dependency rehabilitation, supervised release, and probation? Why aren't they like those kind of conditions?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, I've staked the state's position on the argument that it's irrelevant what the federal registry conditions are and what the Tennessee registry conditions are, because, again, based on the separate sovereign's rationale. So to me, the only thing that's relevant to look at is the state of Alaska conditions. And
let me word this differently. Let me just assume then that the state sovereign's rationale does not apply here. Then what's your best argument as to why these are not onerous conditions sufficient to establish custody or custodial sort of conditions?
Again, you know, I'm sort of going on a categorical argument, but I would say that about the main thing I could say is that Piasecki is an outlier and that the other circuits have not endorsed its rationale, and I would encourage the court to...
Well, let me ask you a question. Does Alaska have the same... If he had stayed in Alaska and violated the registry, would he be subject to the same restrictions that he's now subject to in Tennessee?
No, Alaska... Registry conditions are relatively minimalistic. There's no requirement that you get advance permission to do anything. You have to give notice after the fact, like if you move or change your car registration or things like that, you have to give...
Well, the SORNA requirements would be the same.
They would be, but again, you know, again, my argument is that there are the consequences of a separate sovereign. And so,
is that... Can I ask for clarification? So the SORNA requirements are the same in every state, but then states can add to it. Is that how it works right now?
I believe so, yes.
Okay.
So, in Dow, are you familiar with our case in Dow, where we found that forcing someone to attend 14 hours of alcohol dependency rehabilitation was sufficient to render him in custody? I'm just trying to figure out if that's rendering someone in custody, how is SORNA's lifetime requirements, which are a more, seem to be a more significant restraint on someone's liberty, how are they not?
Again, you know, Piasecki has set out the rationale for why they are, but all I really can do at this juncture is argue that it's an outlier and that this court should follow the precedents from other circuits that don't find that to be sufficiently onerous to constitute custody.
Counsel, I know you're over your time, but I wanted to ask you about the language in Johnson versus United States that you're relying upon to support your argument that Zichko has been called into question. What's the precise language in Johnson that you're relying upon?
I think I'm mostly just relying on the discussion at pages 1577 and 1578 of the opinion, where they discuss their earlier decisions in Custis, and they discuss Daniels versus United States. I'm just relying on their overall endorsement of and description of the prior law.
Well, that's just talking about the ability to collaterally challenge a state conviction.
Yeah, and I, in the press of the moment, I may be missing other language from the opinion, but I think, again, that Lackawanna and Koss are controlling, and that this court in Dubrin and Nunes has essentially recognized that. And again, so I think this court should just go all the way now and recognize that Zichko's rationale has been undercut and so hold. Thank you.
Well, tell me the language in Dubrin that you're saying undercut our ruling in Zichko. What's the language there?
Okay, give me a moment to pull up Dubrin. Dubrin at page 1097 of the opinion at 720 F3rd at 1097 is describing the Lackawanna case. And it correctly describes Lackawanna as saying is that the custody is with respect to the second of two convictions in a sequential and a conviction.
What's the exact language now?
It's the on page 1097. It's where it says, but he is in custody under the 2008 sentence, the constitutionality of which the district court may review. They cite Lackawanna, and that says that remains true even though Durbin erroneously listed
right.
the 2000 conviction. It's
but that doesn't describe the situation that's in Zichko, where there's been a subsequent imprisonment based on the prior conviction.
It undercuts one aspect of Zichko, which is Zichko incorrectly described Lackawanna as saying that the person was in custody with respect to the first of two convictions in a conviction sequence.
So, all right. Thank you, counsel. Are there any other questions from the panel? All right. Rebuttal.
So we covered this in our reply brief, but all of the cases that the respondent is relying on as supposedly undercutting the holding of Zichko, I think are distinguishable in the sense that the cases cited by a respondent involve challenges to a prior conviction that was used to enhance a sentence. Or in the case of the INS case, it was a prior conviction which was resulting in deportation proceedings, but critically invalidating the prior conviction wouldn't have resulted in the deportation proceedings being halted. What we have here is a prior conviction which is the necessary predicate for the subsequent prosecution in Tennessee. We're talking about the fact that if his state conviction in Alaska isn't validated, Mr. Wright will have established his factual innocence on the charge for which he is presently on supervised release. That means that the prior conviction is not as attenuated as it is in the cases cited by a respondent. And I think that's the critical distinction between Zichko and Lackawanna and those other cases that respondent cites. So I'll leave it at that. I think our reply brief covered that issue. And if the court wants a supplemental briefing with respect to the Johnson case and the Duber case, we're happy to submit that.
All right. Please don't send us anything unless we ask.
Understood.
Thank you to both counsel. The case just argued is submitted for decision by the court.